Sourcing Matters Podcast. This is your host, Aaron Niederhelman, sharing stories of our food.
And welcome back to Sourcing Matters. This is your host, Aaron Niederhelman. There's a new school of thought being evaluated in healthcare systems. It's a concept called social determinants of health, which are conditions in the environment in which people are born or live or learn or work, play, worship, or age that affect a wide range of their health, their functioning, and the quality of life and outcomes and risks associated to where they're from, the conditions, the social, economic, and physical in various environments and settings that are proving to be pillars for our well-being or maybe lack thereof. Today we have a guest who is in full discovery mode in the space, serving as executive director of the Design Institute of Health, which is a collaborative between the Dell Medical School and the College of Fine Arts, at the University of Texas at Austin. Today we welcome the founder of the program, Stacy Chang. Hey Stacy, how you doing?
Aaron, so glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
It is always a pleasure. Stacy, I would consider us friends. We've had a chance to know each other for a few years, and I always enjoy our conversations. We get under the hood so quickly. I wonder if we maybe get stuck in the corner because no one else wants to talk to us about these in-depth concepts, or are we just a little off whack?
I don't know. It is the same experience I have every time I'm with you, and so I enjoy it immensely. Maybe your listeners will too.
Hey, yeah. So, well, let's talk about Austin for a moment, because what an interesting and fantastic city down in Texas. You are getting quite a bit of rain in Texas right now. And in fact, you're due for a hurricane or maybe the backlash or side slash of a hurricane coming through. Now, this is a bit of an acclimation for you because you are originally from, or you've spent quite a bit of time on the West Coast in the Bay Area. How are things going down in Austin?
Things are going really well. So I did spend probably about the last 15 years of my life prior to coming to Austin in the Bay Area in Northern California. But this is also my 17th permanent address in the U.S. And so I actually spent a lot of time in the South, including a few years in Texas in my early childhood upbringing. So it's not unfamiliar territory.
Well, that's good. That's good. You can big state, right? We got a lot going on there. A lot of different types of folks. And what is interesting, and from my understanding, the Design Institute of Health is a first-of-its-kind institution dedicated to applying design approaches to solving systemic healthcare challenges that are integrated as part of medical education and training programs. So maybe you could share with our audience what you're working on down at the Design Institute of Health.
Sure. Yeah, so the Design Institute for Health is a bit of an unusual institute. It's not one that you would traditionally find in an academic environment. Certainly not one in between a medical school and a college of fine arts. And it's probably worth explaining a little bit about the circumstances in Austin itself that gave rise to the Design Institute. And
please.
So Austin is an unusual city. We often joke it's a little bit of a blueberry in a bowl of tomato soup, and Austin takes pride in sort of the progressive nature of its citizens. And as a marker of that, 6 years ago now, the residents of Travis County, which is essentially Austin proper, voted to raise the portion of their property taxes that are dedicated to healthcare for the underserved. They voted to raise it by 63%, which is nothing to sneeze at. It's actually quite remarkable. And they did that in order to fund a couple things. One was the build of a new county hospital, which was in disrepair and definitely in need of a rebuild. The second was to fund the creation of a medical school, and that's extremely unusual for a community's dollars to be such a significant component of the support, financial support for a medical school, and I'll tell you about why that matters in a second. But most importantly, the funding underpins health insurance for the poor. So Texas is notable for having not expanded Medicaid and having the largest percentage of uninsured of any of the states in the union. Sits about 18%. So if you live in Texas and you're poor, the likelihood of you getting access to medical care is actually quite low. But if you live in Travis County, that funding provides essentially preventative and health insurance, preventative care, health insurance for that, for any of the citizens who qualify. And there's a financial incentive, obviously, which matters, which is, the top 200 people in Travis County who access medical care and cause the greatest uncompensated reimbursement scenario. You know, they take advantage of the ER and the ambulances and all that stuff that don't get any better, cost the city about $200,000 a person each year. And so if you provide health insurance and give them access to care, you can, care for them for a fraction of that. And so there's an economic motivation to it. But ultimately, we believe that, if we create a healthier society, it'll be more productive. It's frankly the right thing to do, and you might call it socialized healthcare. So those are the circumstances in which the Design Institute arises. And what's most remarkable about the local system is that they've disavowed the traditional fee-for-service system, which is how most of the rest of the U.S. operates, which means, a physician or a hospital system gets paid when they do something, irrespective of whether they improve the condition of the person they were treating. And that creates, some perverse incentives, which leads to the kind of healthcare system with the kinds of outcomes we have now. So here in Austin, we disavowed that. We said we're in pursuit of a value-based care system, primarily because we're funded in large part by the community that wants those better outcomes. And so we pay our providers and health systems here when they make a difference in people's health outcomes. And so that's a big, big shift. And trying to design a system like that is no small feat. And the dean of the medical school, who's an old friend of mine, gave me a call and said, hey, we might be able to make use of something like the creative power of design in trying to build a system from scratch. And so that was the invitation that brought the Design Institute about.
No, let me understand this, because even though you are a blueberry in a bowl of tomato soup, socializing healthcare, I would guess, would not be the tack of selling this. Whereas it seemed what you described to me was a very pragmatic approach, where it saves quite a bit of money for the community if they think more holistically. If it is $200,000 per individual that frequent the ER, maybe this approach of a proactive and preemptive healthcare system that can get rid of some of these externalities is a cost and time saver. Was that part of the appeal?
Absolutely. Yeah, it is about creating a more productive and effective model of healthcare, which we hope serves as a model for others nationally, certainly, and then increasingly internationally. Under the guise of health, so I often say you can't have healthcare reform without healthcare payment reform. And we are the beneficiary of some very regionally focused healthcare payment reform. But that's actually under the umbrella of national healthcare payment reform. So most of the reimbursements that the Centers for Medicaid and Medicaid Services will provide by the end of this year, 80% of them will have a value-based component to them. So the industry is already shifting. It's just the challenge is that most of the existing systems don't know how to respond to those shifts in payment reform. And we're getting a chance to actually do that pretty far ahead of the curve.
In your bio, it states that you're working with invested stakeholders in the healthcare ecosystem and harnessing the resources of the university. The Design Institute is focusing on creating human-centered solutions in every area of the patient and provider experience, all with a focus on improving people's health outcomes and healthcare experiences. So many of the aforementioned social determinants of health that I led with seem to be tied or maybe proven to lifestyle choices of consumers or patients. Smoking, drinking, drugs, sure. I mean, that's a no-brainer. But when I was, we're looking at what we're talking about, and a lot of things we focus here on Sourcing Matters is, in speaking of food, what will we put in our body, primary impact on our health, and what is that primary impact on our health? Are you looking at directly at food and nutrition at the Institute as one of these social determinants of health?
Yeah, absolutely. And so let me get to that in a slightly roundabout way.
Okay.
So first of all, I think not everyone recognizes that, what determines an individual person's health, what we call the determinants of health, come in a lot of different varieties. And your access to and the quality of your medical care only contributes to about 20% at best of your individual health outcomes. And I think that's stunning for most people. Most people can assume that the quality of and the access to healthcare accounts for much more. The rest of it, the other 80%, is all the things that you mentioned, right? Behavioral in some aspects, genetics in some aspects, but most of it's in in the environment you live in, the community where you live, you know, thrive, the food you eat, the exercise you have access to, your social connections, your family, your community, things like that. And so if we're, as a system, trying to improve the health of an individual, it would make sense then that if 80% of the determinants are not medical care, that we'd spend some time focusing on those, right? You know, housing is a health intervention. You can't expect someone to get better unless they're housed first, not the other way around. So amongst all those things, then, you know, our primary sustenance, food, is a huge determinant of our health, and then the quality of that food and the access to it. You know, unfortunately, you know, Austin, as a legacy, you know, born from 100 years ago, ranks as one of the, you know, essentially tops the list of large cities in the U.S. with the greatest economic disparity. And that means there is a dividing line, literally I-35, you know, the interstate, which sort of divides the haves and the have-nots historically. Now, Austin, to its credit, has been trying to overcome that legacy for probably the last three generations, but some of those early policy choices when, you know, we were less informed and evolved as a society persist. And so you have these neighborhoods that are traditionally unserved, right? You know, the best grocery store you have is what's on the snack shelf at the liquor store. You know, your access to green space and your access to transportation, all those things are actually quite limited. And we notice in a lot of these neighborhoods, and we've been spending quite a bit of time in them, when we ask them, you know, what do they want? You know, when residential developers come in and they say, hey, what do you want in your community, which is actually sometimes an unusual question, like, real estate developers don't always ask. The community responds with health. They said health. And we said, well, what do you mean by health? Do you mean an acute medical clinic on the street corner? And they're like, no, we have that. In fact, that's what happens after we get sick. We actually want to get and stay healthy. We don't want to just be addressed once we're sick. So we dug in a little bit more, and they start talking about things that really are the litany of social determinants of health. They are, they said, we need better jobs. We need economic empowerment. We need housing, affordable housing, durably affordable housing. And then the one that's most consistent and actually serves as a really interesting leverage point is food. Not only is it necessary for sustenance, but it actually happens to be at the center of the social fabric of a lot of these communities, right? People gather around meals. They share their recipes. They show their generosity by cooking for others. And so food, both as a nutritive mechanism and as a social mechanism, becomes a really important thing to actually pay attention to. So we've now spent the better part of 2 or 3 years actually understanding the power of food on all those fronts and starting to develop interventions for that.
I mean, fascinating, right? If folks on the other side of the tracks, not even just getting access to the nutrition that they need, and how it perpetuates, how it grows, how it snowballs over generations, right? And
right.
And infrastructure builds around that. And I think many of us don't think, you know, we don't think twice about that. Whereas if this is a proactive and preemptive approach to solving many of what we've got, where you probably know better than I, but I've heard the statistics saying that our reactionary healthcare costs are 18% of GDP at this point.
Wow. Yeah, right. And exactly. And I have to keep revising that figure because the move goes up by a percentage point every time I look away.
Yeah. Well, I can add a few points to it because I'm not in the space, so I can just throw in there for you know, bombastic excitement theory. So that's fine. I'll just 86%, Stacey, I hear, is tied to that. No, it is. I mean, amazing statistic on the volumes of resources that we require for that. But let me ask this, if I could, regarding food systems, and really, you know, I would be intrigued to see some of your whiteboard sessions where you've got circles that overlap, and you probably have hundreds of circles by the time you break down. You're tackling a big problem here. I mean, you're looking at major systems overlapping with us as the key or the crux of the change agent here. But do you, when you look at those links in the chain, do you look at things like food waste or environmental impact of creating food, or maybe even more directly to individual, you know, human health, some of the public health concerns tied to the production of cheap food, like superbugs? Do you guys get into that space, or is that maybe 3-4 years down the line when you really start going, you know, out of those concentric circles?
You know, it's hard to ignore it, right? You know, the first thing you concern yourself with, which is the most immediate need, is just lack of food. Right? And then you look at food pantries and they're filling school lunch bags, you know, the ones that they pack with all sorts of food that frankly is not very good for you. It may fill their stomach, but it's certainly not providing nutritive value. And then you see the consequence, you know, of that food some 15 years later. So let me give you an example. So if you map sort of the economic disparity across the geographic map of this region, there's an area we call the Eastern Crescent, where essentially the poor and underserved end up for a lot of different reasons. And then if you map, you know, availability, you know, grocery stores and food store, and they're absent in that crescent, but you'll find liquor stores and things like that, and the kind of food that is available, or even where food pantries deliver food. And then you see, you know, overlaid on that, a similar map of, you know, mothers who get inadequate prenatal care or nutrition, right? And it looks exactly the same. There's a dark band in that Eastern Crescent. And then 15 years after those kids are born, you track kids with high BMI, multiple, you know, chronic diseases like diabetes, obesity, and hypertension, and they're in middle school, and they map exactly to the same Eastern Crescent. You begin to see what happens when you don't pay attention not only to the access to food, but to the quality of that food, because they're eating, but they're definitely not eating well.
So up until 2014, when you joined the or you founded the Design Institute of Health, you served as the managing director of the healthcare practice at IDEO, which is a global design and innovation firm. You have clients that include government, research institutions, hospitals, companies include pharma, insurance, medical. You had many people turning to you for new designs, new perspective. So you had touched on this a little bit in the beginning, but why did you decide to leave such a high-profile position in a thought-leading company like that in the Bay Area for a relatively unproven idea in Texas?
that's a good, sensible question. I'll tell you, working at IDEO was fantastic, right? You know, for someone with, I suppose, undiagnosed ADD, it's the perfect antidote to that. You know, you get to work on remarkably interesting problems with every swath of industry, and you get to do, you know, dozens of those projects every year, so at least, you know, when you lead a practice like that. But ultimately, and I was at IDEO for a long time, it ends up being a little bit unfulfilling. And the reason is this. You're only actually ever working on the edges of the dysfunction. You're working on projects that, on the margins, you know, might make profit for an individual company in the sliver of the industry they're in, but you're never tackling the core of the issue, right? And, you know, maybe I'm overly mission-driven, but the point of actually working on healthcare is actually to improve the human condition. And if you're only scratching the surface, you kind of have to ask yourself, am I working on the things that really make a difference? And so when this opportunity arose, and it wasn't oversold. I thought it was at first until I came down and visited. This is an opportunity for us to, from as blank a slate as we can manage, you know, start to build some of the systems that we think should be the way they should be from scratch. That's really tough. it is the hardest work I've done in my lifetime, which is saying something. But it is also the most rewarding because we are actually working at the center of the dysfunction. We're working at the payment models, at the care models. We're working at the across the entire panoply of determinants of health, right? We're not focused just on one procedure or one technology or one device. We're actually focused on the system model. And that's a real privilege, actually, to be able to work on.
So good. You're like, I love you just get the awesome stump speeches. You nail them every time. It's good stuff, Stacey. That's good. hey, we met because we shared the same year in an Eisenhower fellowship. And talking about kind of in joking manner, I think we have volumes of people who go through that are also undiagnosed ADD folks, including myself, that you uncover a few rocks and boy, you find that passion and it just gets you going, right? It doesn't become work, even though it's all consuming, it doesn't become work. And that's what I surely recognized in speaking with you. In your program, you evaluated healthcare innovation and developed economies and policies healthcare innovation in developing economies and policy and social approaches to healthcare improvement. So can you tell us a bit or our audience a bit more about your time spent in Sweden and Kenya?
Yeah, absolutely. So it was an odd pairing of countries, Kenya and Sweden, but it was very intentional. And so I went to Kenya to look at innovations that can happen in constrained environments, you know, environments with constrained resources. And there's often this sort of first world notion that, you know, innovation only happens in the well-funded places. And I was headed to Texas to work in really constrained environments where there isn't a ton of funding. There's a lot of issues that have to be addressed. And I thought, well, if I'm going to learn about where that's been successful, I should probably go to a place where they've been doing that work for a long time. So that was my interest in Kenya. So I didn't actually spend any time really in the state-sponsored health system. I spent it in the peri-urban areas and in the urban slums where resources are extremely constrained. And yet you would find healthcare entities not just surviving, but actually thriving. And in a scenario like that, they must be delivering some incredible value because, you know, when a citizen there has a dollar to spend, they either choose food or something else, usually food. And if they're choosing it to spend it on healthcare, man, it must be doing something really remarkable. So for me, it was an opportunity to see essentially what it meant to be innovative in a scenario where you didn't think you could because you probably didn't have the circumstances or certainly the resources to do it. So that was actually quite inspiring, actually seeing the kinds of ecosystems that were built up in you know, Kibera, which is like, I think, the largest slum probably in the world, arguably. Was kind of amazing. And it started, and this returns us to the original notion, it didn't start with medical care. It actually started with actually addressing the social needs of the community. I sat down with this one director working on HIV and AIDS prevention, and he drew me this, it's still poignant in my mind. He drew me this really simple diagram. He wrote AIDS, and he drew an arrow, a half circle, down to poverty, and then he drew another half circle and arrow back to AIDS. And he said, we're really not here to solve AIDS first. We're here to solve poverty first. Once you solve poverty, then you can start to have an effect on AIDS, right? And once you have AIDS, then you begin to have an effect on poverty. And it really is a virtuous cycle like that. And that was, for me, the most poignant description of why addressing social determinants matter. You can actually develop a context in which someone wants to address the disease until they solve for all the other issues. You know, here in Austin, you hear a clinician complain, oh, that person had cancer and didn't show up for the chemotherapy appointment. And then you ask the patient, why didn't you show up for your chemotherapy appointment? And she says, well, if I missed another half day of work, which I would have if I had gotten that appointment, then I would have lost my job. I would have been unable to feed my kids. And actually, they matter more than the cancer I have right now. And so, you know, those things have direct relevance. You just have to be able to extract that universal intelligence and then apply it elsewhere. So that was Kenya, which is remarkable and life-changing. And then I went to Sweden because, you know, it's held aloft as a really sentient, sort of thoughtful system that develops pretty remarkable health outcomes. I want to understand structurally how you actually develop that.
Yeah, Bernie Sanders ran his campaign off of that, didn't he? Like campaigns to Sweden, right. Yeah.
And it was interesting. You know, the first person I met with in Sweden was the head of the parliamentary committee for healthcare. And I said, well, you must wield a lot of power. She's actually, I wield very little. In fact, I wield very little because I actually have very little funding. All the healthcare in Sweden is provincially taxed, and you know, the income is derived from local taxation, and healthcare is delivered locally. And I said, well, tell me about that. Wouldn't a national model create some economies of scale or best practices and things like that? She's like, well, no. She said, because a model of medicine that works in an urban enclave like Stockholm looks dramatically different than a model of medicine or healthcare that you would deploy, you know, north of the Arctic Circle where there's less population density than the Sahara Desert. She's like, those two models overlap very little. And if we were to be arrogant enough at a national level to try to prescribe one unified model for everybody, it'd be average for everyone, which pretty means much means terrible for everyone. And so they require the provinces to fund and then deliver their healthcare. But what they do every year is they say, look, we do have, you know, common problems, you know, diabetes is on the rise. Let's study what you do. And because we measure everything, and that's critically important, we actually then actually know what your interventions do or how they affect outcomes. And then we can actually distill down which kinds of interventions are universally applicable across every venue and which ones aren't. We take the ones that are universally applicable, we make them country standards, and then we move on to our next problem. And then when we need to come back and improve, we'll come back and revisit the problem. It was an incredibly conscious approach to actually solving for healthcare problems, one that's actually more discovery-based than sort of prescription-based. And I thought that was remarkable.
It's working on almost a common sense model, right? I mean, it's similar to what you're saying, too. We take the similar type scenario in food production. Maybe food and healthcare are similar in the fact that scale seems to come with expense, and that expense is often values that are associated and affect us. And boy, it sounds like in Sweden they've kind of approached it differently. Is it something where they were able to restructure or redefine it, or is it just that that's naturally how this has come up through the ranks in their relatively small GDP, but nonetheless they have a model, provable model.
They've proven a model. It's actually quite intentional, and it's not this notion of sort of trickle up common sense. They actually they go and mine the intelligence for evolving the health system, and they're smart enough to divide between what is universally applicable and what needs to be regionally managed. And I think that's the real intelligence in that system. I was going to say there are some direct parallels we could draw between the notion of locally sourced food and locally sourced healthcare. I think they're exactly the same notion.
Hmm. So more generally, Stacey, let me ask this. I guess that for the monumental task that you've adopted as your own, you must try to find a common language. So like an architecture sharing similar protocols where all stakeholders can communicate in harmony. So with that, why does the healthcare system still refer to food, you know, the proactive approach or the preventative approach here? They often still refer to food as medicine. Shouldn't it be food as preventative care?
Yeah, it should. It absolutely should. But here's the dysfunction, right? In the U.S. healthcare system, the system itself, the providers and the hospital systems, they get paid when people get really sick. They get paid better when people get really sick. You know, we have really groundbreaking, you know, technology and science, and we can apply it at will. The system, because of the payment model, incentivizes the system to not prevent illness, but actually to wait for people to get ill and then actually to solve for that. There's another piece of it, and, you know, maybe we're invoking Bernie Sanders here, but, you know, if you're an individual and you're insured by a commercial insurance company, any investment they make in your health, which has a return on investment that's, you know, to what, 10, 20, 30 years out, doesn't actually make sense to them because as soon as you change a job, that investment they made will be lost. And so without universal health insurance and durably universal health insurance and shared risk and all those sorts of things, the economic model doesn't actually incentivize preventative care. You know, if you had a single government payer, then they would be investing in terms of health insurance on the behalf of the entire community or society, and they'd be doing it over the entire lifespan of those individuals. And that return on investment actually makes sense. But when we break it down into a commercial system like we have, it doesn't. The incentives don't align. And that's the fundamental problem.
You started this in 2014 down in Austin, obviously under a very different administration. Current administration has a different perspective. How do you juggle the social, political, the situation in D.C. on a national level? Or do you just kind of go about it as a sandboxed environment? You deal with what you can deal with there and prove out a model. Where do you sit on that fence at this point?
We sit astride that fence. You know, we have the benefit of a local payment model that is perfectly aligned with what we're trying to produce locally and regionally in our community outcomes. So that is mostly unaffected by what's happening in the national political environment. But here's the interesting thing: all the payment reform that's happening, you know, values-based outcomes and value-based models of care, was actually originally, you know, Republican notion, right? And no matter what administration is in place, they are faced with the specter of a GDP spending, you know, 18 and the 19 and the 20% that will eventually engulf the economy. And so it is not really a partisan issue. I mean, the news media likes to make it so, and shouting from the tabloids makes it more entertaining for sure. But the very economic reality of what healthcare costs means to the nation means that each of the parties actually is actively making progress and working on it. You know, even in the shift to this administration, it was heartening for me to visit Washington and visit the people, you know, in the Department of Health and Human Services. They're all still doing the yeoman's work. They're still doing the hard work necessary to you know, turn this huge ship. And so we haven't really noticed dramatically how any of the shift in the national policy has affected our work and generally our colleagues in other regions as well.
Hmm. So you said it's the impetus of a Republican policy. Was it from Romney in Massachusetts or was it another?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. RomneyCare originally, you know, was RomneyCare, then was Obamacare, then, you know, was not so much. But some of some of the most critical aspects persist in those policies. And, you know, we won't turn it back the clock on those. And more importantly, the payment reform that's happening at the CMS level is actually driving most of the change.
Huh. I'm going to share a quick tidbit of information I learned from my work within the fisheries in the Northeast. I learned that Romney used as his model the Gloucester, Massachusetts Fisherman's Wife Program when they brought together a healthcare program as his framework for building that out. So the Fisherman's Wife Program in Massachusetts, in Gloucester, Massachusetts, was the framework used for all of Obamacare. How about that? Look at that. Well, we'll turn it back to Massachusetts, isn't it?
I love it.
Let me ask this, if I could, Stacey. So when you get everything set up, when you fix the healthcare system and it rolls out and kind of save the day, approximately what year will I see you as Beto's Texas wingman in Senate?
Well, the short answer, I have no political aspirations. I'll start with that. but the real answer is the work will never be done.
Yeah.
And the reason for that is, you know, it would be disingenuous for us to pretend like, oh, we'll create a model and it'll persist for 20 years because disease changes, populations change, demographics, technology, consumer expectations, there, medicine and science, progress on those fronts. They're constantly in flux. And for us to pretend like we could actually build any model that would persist for longer than, you know, than a couple of years is ridiculous. Yeah. It's frankly ridiculous. And so there has to be a mindset shift. And this is really, you know, at the crux of the problem for healthcare systems, which is this is an ongoing evolution. It is continuous refinement. It is a learning laboratory that we have to embrace with courage, because that's the only way we'll continue to serve, you know, the charge we have from society, which is to keep them healthy. So the nature of disease now is really different than it was, you know, even for our parents' generation, right? You know, 40 years ago, you know, people mostly died from acute trauma or infection. We've actually mostly solved those. You know, our tools and technology are great. Our vaccinations are good. The kind of stuff that kills us now, the sort of the nature of disease today is actually really different. Diabetes and hypertension, obesity, loneliness, suicide, depression, those are things that don't get fixed in a clinical environment. They are part of our inbuilt lives. We have to figure out how to create models of care that actually persist when we leave the doctor's office. And so that portends a very different model, one that's pretty far away from what we have now. So when we get to a model like that, well, first of all, I'll probably be dead. But it will be constantly refreshing. It will be a living model, not one that we sort of anoint and then put on the mantelpiece.
Yeah, well, it's changing behaviors, right? It's preventative care by what we eat and the lifestyle choices we make. And, you know, maybe behavior change going back to the Senate. I have no doubt that you will, this is your life mission. You will solve a great deal in your time period. It's just a matter of where you decide to tighten the screws. So maybe it is right next to Beto right there at some point. If I was in Texas, he'd have my vote. How's that?
Yeah, very good.
Stacey, where can our listening audience learn more about what you're up to down at the Design Institute for Health? Is the best place on the web?
Yep. So we have a home at designinhealth.org. It actually features a lot of the very honest case studies of the work that they're doing. We talk about the challenges we face, the things that we've succeeded at, and the things we have yet to succeed at. And then some really interesting notions about how you might think about the healthcare system differently than you do now.
Well, that's fantastic. I'll include a link at the bottom of the write-up. And, you know, what exciting work you're doing here for a value-based approach based on health outcomes. Again, just a common-sense approach. And to have you, Stacey, leading the way here in your experience in dealing on the in the free marketplace, having international exposure on both sides of the spectrum, and then really starting to implement this within a new place down in Travis County with that funding program and looking at it as a pragmatic approach to dealing with a perpetual problem. But boy, that is exciting. So, and again, from our perspective here at Sourcing Matters, that connection point to those determinants of health, the perpetual approach to eating and lifestyle choices and the food that we select, that's it moves us in closer to that direction that food is preventative care. So, Stacey, I can't thank you enough for partaking in today's conversation. I'll just say until next time.
Absolutely. My pleasure, Aaron.